This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A big company marches onto your land, sinks a well without your permission, then proceeds to threaten your livelihood.
The drilling sites are springing up like topsy all over their farms, some with significant gas leakage. And Australia's greatest underground water resource, the Great Artesian Basin, will be contaminated and depleted.
And it's our laws and our politicians who are letting it happen.
Big business lusts for dough. The government conducts the flow, prostituting our mother Earth, getting dough. Every time I'm rapping, I'm attacking them, and mines explode because my flows are more toxic than hydraulic fracturing. They slaughter animals and all the flora and fauna. Emissions cause a change in the climate till it's more of a sauna, hotter than the flammable water that they pour for your daughters and sons, without a thought for their poor little tummies or the smog in their lungs. It's a war they keep going as long as the dollars will come. They spend millions on propaganda to keep the populace dumb. They say they want to keep the economy strong, but for everyone that profits, there's 100 struggling, wondering what's going on. Awful corporations bought the nation for a donation, causing mortification from ocean water to the core of the nation. You know I won't stop till they all know the facts, and we take Australia back before it's gasland.
It's time to rock again.
You just heard Act Locally, Think Globally by McShay Jasmine and the Awesomes. It's from a whole album of 14 anti-fracking songs called Whole Lot of Fracking Going On. It's a great new album available from www.wholelotoffrackinggoingon.com. With the help of our feature background artist this week, Australia's own Ariel Kalma. And thanks to singer-organizer Laura Doe for sending this along. That's right, we humans aren't satisfied polluting the atmosphere with toxic guck, radioactive particles, and greenhouse gases. Nope, not finished with spreading all our poisons over the surface of every continent either. We just can't rest until we manage to take the most toxic chemical crap we've got and injecting it at least a mile underground. All to get more carbon-trapping gases to burn out the climate. It's the last frontier, the deep underground, and we'll poison the last fresh water and blow out the coal seams if we can. The frackers are hitting Australia right now. Their drilling rigs will set up, blow up the deep, and then move on endlessly till there's nothing left. Get ready in Britain for more of the same. Now that the North Sea gas field production is 25% down, they'll tell you it's green, much cleaner than coal. Green all the way down to a wrecked planet with more fossil fuels. Just wait for the Marcellus gas fracking field in New York State to leak into the watershed for millions of people. Oops. The roving drill companies will fold into their corporate shells and evaporate, leaving the groundwater poisoned for centuries. Before we get to the unreported panic in the Arctic, and before we count up the late record rate of extinctions with author Peter Sale, and even before we interview the filmmaker who tracked down big oil crime, all coming up on Radio EcoShock.
Oh my God, breaking up!
Rushed expedition finds methane torches in the Arctic. The research ship RV Polarstern has returned to Bremerhaven, Germany, with its crew of scientists from six countries. They traveled almost 12,000 nautical miles on the 26th Arctic expedition, measuring ice in the polar seas. The verdict? Arctic sea ice is young and very thin. For centuries, polar seas have been covered by a thick layer of ice built up over many years. America designed a nuclear submarine capable of breaching up through and breaking that tough Arctic ice. Now it's weak, with much less mass, the first step towards losing the Arctic ice cap due to global warming. Greenpeace icebreaker Arctic Sunrise is just now returning to Amsterdam after a two-month expedition with scientists from Cambridge studying ice thickness. The news is alarming, as the Earth's new dark seascape in the summer Arctic will pump more heat into the oceans and add to long-term climate change. Scientist Wiesław Maslowski's team predict the Arctic ice cap could disappear in summer as early as 2016. There is worse, and you won't hear this in the mainstream media at all. Behind the scenes, officials and scientists in various countries and governments went into panic mode this September. The problem? A big increase in methane gas was reported by ships traveling the northern route, and methane gas has been discovered in the eastern Arctic. If frozen methane gas under the sea, technically called clathrates, melt in quantity, we are on the road to a dramatic climate shift beyond imagination. It happened before, around 56 million years ago. In less than 100 years, the temperature of the Arctic seas rose several degrees, reaching almost 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 30 degrees centigrade. Here is what we know. On September 2nd, the Russian news agency RIA Novosti announced, quote, "A group of Russian and U.S. scientists will leave the port of Vladivostok on Friday on board a Russian research ship to study methane emissions in the eastern part of the Arctic. This expedition was organized on a short notice by the Russian Fund of Fundamental Research and the U.S. National Science Foundation following the discovery of a dramatic increase in the leakage of methane gas from the seabed in the eastern part of the Arctic," said Professor Igor Samilitov, the head of the expedition. The group consists of 27 scientists who would attempt to measure the scale of methane emissions and clarify the nature of the process. The 45-day expedition will focus on the sea shelf of the Laptev Sea, the East Siberian Sea, and the Russian part of the Chukotsk Sea, where 90% of the underwater permafrost is located. "We assume that the leakage of methane results from the degradation of underwater permafrost. A massive release of such powerful greenhouse gas may accelerate global warming," Samilitov said. End quote from the Russian press September 2nd. Methane is generally said to be 20 times more powerful than CO2 when it comes to trapping solar heat. That is really just an average, because when it first emerges, methane can be as much as 75 times more powerful. It degrades more quickly than CO2, becoming less potent in about 10 years. But methane degrades into CO2, continuing the greenhouse gases for up to 100,000 years, according to Dr. David Archer. So what did this hurry-up research find? We go with the report September 29th from the Russian news agency Itar-Tass. Heavy methane emissions found in the Arctic eastern sector. In the northern sector of the Laptev and Bering Seas, the chief of the expedition, Igor Samilitov, reported by phone that, quote, "methane torches," his words, "are coming from the ocean seabed into the atmosphere." Also on board were scientists from Alaska Fairbanks Scientific Research Center and Georgia University. "I can only conclude that as the Arctic Sea melts back every summer and seas warm, methane from either deep in the ground or from clathrates on the shallower seabeds are starting to melt." The Russians and scientists from the National Oceanography Center in the UK have found methane is leaking up also from fissures deep inside the earth, so we have both frozen methane on the shallow seabeds and geological methane coming up. That the Russians and Americans sent a ship to the Arctic on such short notice tells you how serious this is. Keep in mind, there is no overall way to monitor methane emissions from the whole Arctic, although scientists do monitor global average methane content in the atmosphere. According to my limited research, the amounts coming out of the Arctic so far are smaller than emissions from rice paddies. We haven't seen anything like a giant increase in methane globally yet. But we are seeing the start of a methane source that could, if it grows, easily tip the planet into a new greenhouse world. Keep your eye on the Arctic methane news.
It's a sense of loss. You know, I mean, your future is very uncertain. You know that you're up against one of the most powerful industries in the world, and the industry and the state and federal governments, they're just looking for the money. Mm. And unfortunately, the human cost is not on their agenda.
Sooner or later, we see the black dragon behind our oil addiction. These are the mega corporations who span the world. They have private armies of security men and the biggest military in the world behind them. They own politicians, private jets, and maybe a few countries. But the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of big oil is the river of money available for public relations. Advertising sues us, movie placements make us want more. The oil industry is the subtle pusher who keeps us addicted, keeps us coming back to the pumps, keeps us buying plastic products and oil-based foods. If only someone could tell it like it is. That would be Craig Rosebrough. Don't be fooled by the technical-sounding name of his upcoming film. Greedy Lying Bastards is no puff piece for the industry. Craig, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, I appreciate you having me.
Tell us about your new film, just briefly. What should we expect?
Well, this is an inside look at the oil industry, its power and corruption, and really the deceit that it's used to maintain its power and keep all of us addicted to its products. And so, you know, we spent a good amount of time, just about 3 years, traveling around the world and documenting this industry, the impact it's had on nations around the world in terms of not only environmental contamination, but also strong issues like climate change. We documented the impact the industry has on our political process here in the United States in terms of the amount of money it gives to lobbying and PR campaigns, really to confuse us and keep us all once again addicted to their products and ensure that we do not have a clean energy policy in this country.
Well, when it comes to the greedy part, I think about drilling in the Arctic. The fossil fuel companies trigger a massive melting, which should scare the pants off us. And instead of recognizing the danger, they set up big platforms in newly ice-free areas to get more oil to make more climate change. What are some of the things that you cover about climate change in the movie?
One of the things I wanted to look at in the film and in the investigation was why we have this apparent disparity between the scientific body around the world, which is in a what could be considered a consensus opinion based on scientific documentation that human-caused climate change is real and that we need to do something about it. So that's on one hand, and yet on another hand, we have public opinion in the United States very, very low in terms of a belief in climate change, and therefore, you know, no pressure on our political realm to pass any legislation that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So I wanted to try and figure out why we have that disparity. Science is telling us one thing, and public opinion is completely another. I wanted to figure out why that is. And sure enough, there is a reason for it. And one of the things that we look at is the amount of money that certain companies within this industry spend annually to ensure that there are very, very strong and powerful PR campaigns that confuse us about the issue. They have spent millions of dollars in the last decade alone to fund think tanks, to fund front groups with friendly sounding names who have sometimes scientists, and a lot of times they're not scientists, that come out publicly on, you know, news media organizations like Fox News, and their whole focus is to cast doubt on whether or not climate change exists. And that really has had a instrumental effect at decreasing public support for climate change legislation in this country.
And you do give a little screen time to some of the worst climate deniers.
We do indeed. I felt it was important, you know, not just to talk about the dire impact of this PR campaign waged by the industry, but to actually show it for what it is. So we let the most prominent, what we call climate change deniers in the world, speak on film, and we kind of let them, in a sense, bury themselves by their erratic scientific theories and sometimes just by their sheer rhetoric. And I think that's the most honest way to do it. You know, if we have a scientific fact that can be proven, that's agreed upon by the leading academies around the world, scientific academies around the world, you know, that's something that we should act upon. We shouldn't be, you know, waiting for tomorrow to decide whether or not we're going to protect, you know, our country and the planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Craig Roseborough, the writer and director of a new film about big oil called Greedy Lying Bastards. In your new film, Craig, you spent some serious time in the Gulf of Mexico area both before and after the April 2010 deepwater disaster, that BP rig. BP spent a lot of advertising money saying they would make things right for the residents. Did that happen?
From our investigation, overall, no. What BP appeared to do was, again, very, very similar to what we were just talking about. They waged a very, very fierce PR campaign to make it look like, you know, they were using their best efforts to clean up the Gulf and to help the residents in need. And what we found was, you know, largely the opposite. On our first trip down there in 2010, we talked with, you know, one of the fathers whose son died aboard the Deepwater Horizon, and then talked with some of the out-of-work fishermen and business owners down there. And, you know, at that time, everybody initially who put in a claim that was anywhere near legitimate got a $5,000 payoff from BP, and that was called an interim claim. And the problem came with the intermediate claims that came, the follow-up claims, as the months went by and as the oil continued to gush out and the contamination continued to be with the area down there. And to date, of the $20 million or billion-dollar claims fund that BP set up, that Kenneth Feinberg is administering, there's estimates that only 16% of that total fund has been paid out to the applicants, you know, the Gulf residents who've been impacted. And there's a lot of people down there, a lot of people who still have yet to get any significant reimbursement for their losses. And of course, when we went down there the second year in 2011 to see kind of what the aftermath was a year later, the health impacts are what were the most startling, where people were suffering just very, very dire health problems from a combination of the crude, the contamination from the crude that was washing ashore, as well as the dispersant, the Corexit that was applied, and the aerosol that was coming in, you know, through the air and harming the residents down there. So it was a very big mess indeed. And getting back to your question, no, I don't believe that they came anywhere close to making the Gulf whole again.
And I've heard that some of the victims of toxic chemicals are having trouble finding a doctor to treat them.
That's exactly correct. That was another startling fact when we went down there, is that a lot of times when victims or the ill residents were going in and seeking medical attention, they were being denied medical attention in terms of being treated for chemical toxicity because of how integrated and how strong the industry is in the culture down in the South. A lot of the doctors either have direct clients or a part of the industry down in the Gulf down there, and not a lot of people honestly wanted to come up against BP in the industry, you know, if it came down to any kind of court battle where they had to prove, you know, that this particular client or this particular patient, for instance, was suffering X health problem because of Corexit, for instance. So there were a few. Dr. Mike Robichaud in Louisiana is considered a local hero by many people down there, and he's been one that's kind of paid for a lot of out of his own pocket the treatments for a lot of the sick residents down there.
And I even heard about one case in Florida where some people were just swimming on a beach. They weren't close to the tankers. They weren't close to Corexit, they thought, but they still had serious health problems come out of it.
That's correct. That was one of the severe cases that we investigated. Stephen Aguinaga and his friend Merrick Valian went with their wives. They were lifelong friends. They went down to the Gulf Coast in Florida on a little vacation, and they were told by the local hotel there and the local authorities that it was safe to go in the water because the oil didn't wash up in that area. And the beaches, of course, they said, looked completely clean, so they didn't think there was any problem with it. They went in the water and went swimming. You know, they were in there for about an hour and a half, and when Stephen came out, his wife noticed there was this orange goo all over him that was just stuck to him. And they didn't really think, put two and two together and think it was, you know, oil or anything like that. But all four of them started experiencing kind of flu-like symptoms that evening and didn't, again, put two and two together. They just thought maybe they all came down with something or something they ate. So the next day, Stephen's friend Merrick, he went back in the water again and swam for another couple hours. And he came out and felt even sicker than he did earlier the night before. So within 3 weeks, Stephen was suffering extreme health problems due to the toxic exposure that he was faced with from swimming in there, and his friend Merrick Valian actually died. From what we can tell and looking at his medical records, he was in very good health. He was a young guy in his, I believe, early 30s at the time. And for all intents and purposes, it appears, though, the toxic exposure that he was faced with swimming repeatedly in basically pools of crude led to his death.
Craig Roseborough, tell us about your testing of Gulf food sea safety, the seafood safety there.
Yes, we had talked with a couple chemists down there who have been testing the soil, the water, and the seafood for safety in terms of the level of petroleum hydrocarbons, and really comparing that with what the federal government had been saying is safe. And so they had told us when we were down there that their findings were completely different than what the federal government were coming up with, and their findings in terms of the toxicity of seafood were not safe for human consumption. So I thought it would be interesting for us to take our own test, and I went down on Grand Isle and collected a sample of sand. We collected water, And I also bought some fresh-caught Gulf shrimp that were right off the boat there in Grand Isle. And we took them into an independent lab for testing. And the results came back a few weeks later. I was just amazed. The results were 4,900 parts per million of petroleum hydrocarbons, which is 10 times higher than the safe limit set by the FDA after the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So our shrimp were 10 times more toxic than the safe consumption level. And these are shrimp that when I was standing in line to buy them, other families and purveyors and, you know, local retailers were buying the same shrimp and were selling them and eating them that day. So it was really startling to see that direct evidence of how toxic that food supply is. And then just to think about, oh my gosh, is that seafood all over saturated in the U.S. food supply right now? And unfortunately, for all intents and purposes, it is.
And then they had the scientific test, which was just to smell it and see if it was okay.
Yeah. That is something that's hard for me to believe, is that the majority of the testing that was done and promoted by the federal government in terms of the safety limit for consumption of fish came down to a smell test. That was just beyond me. I just couldn't realize that that was actually true and not just some sort of joke, you know, a really, really dark joke. And then, of course, when we did take that test ourselves and the results came back at 10 times higher, the safe limit set by the FDA of petroleum hydrocarbons, it just confirmed that their test obviously isn't working.
Is this film, Greedy Lying Bastards, just about the United States?
It is not. This industry is not just a national industry within the United States. It's an industry that is worldwide, and its existence relies upon its ability to continue to explore worldwide. And so we actually filmed in a total of 14 countries, but I think in the final cut of the film, the footage comes from about 9 countries around the world. And what we looked at, not only was the industry and its contamination, but we talked with scientists, politicians, as well as individuals and communities that are impacted by the industry all around the world, from Uganda and also Kenya down to Peru. We were over in Tuvalu, as well as up in Kivalina, which is a small Inupiaq Native American community off the northwestern coast of Alaska above the Arctic Circle. And a lot of the locations, we wanted to look at the direct evidence today of climate change and what it is actually doing to individual communities, a lot of times subsistence communities, and the impacts that are faced as a result of the reckless and unchecked release of these greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere. And the results were startling, honestly, just to see the impacts to these small communities.
If you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. My guest is Craig Roseborough, and we're talking about his upcoming film, Greedy Lying Bastards. So, Craig, who are some of the people that you got on camera for this movie, and maybe tell us a couple that you tried and couldn't get?
Sure. We have a lot of people on camera for the film, and the hard part, of course, is we have so much information trying to actually whittle it down and figure out, you know, in our final cut, what's going to be the most impactful and tell our story the best. But some of the most prominent, you know, individuals we have in the film include Representative Henry Waxman from California, of course, who's been a strong proponent of clean energy policies in the country. Of course, he was one of the sponsors of the Waxman-Markey bill, co-writer of it. We have Christine Todd Whitman, who is the former EPA administrator under the Bush-Cheney administration, as well as a former New Jersey governor. We interviewed Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, as well as Achim Steiner, the Executive Director of the United Nations Environmental Program. Those are some of the top-level kind of politicians we interviewed. We have, as we spoke earlier, we have a number of the climate change deniers who are funded, either they or their organizations are heavily funded by the industry itself. That includes Myron Ebell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We feature Tim Phillips from the Americans for Prosperity organization, which was created by Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, and whose chairman is still David Koch. We feature James Inhofe. That was Someone we tried to get an interview with is Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. We tell his story largely through archival footage because he turned down our interview. Unfortunately, he was one of the ones we tried to get and weren't successful, but we do a great job of telling his story. He's kind of the ARC global warming denier in the Senate. He has kind of gone out of his way. Interestingly enough, his number one donor in terms of financial donor of all time is Koch Industries. And above and beyond those, we also have a lot of interesting and very compelling human stories, some from the Gulf of Mexico and the individuals that were really impacted, either through the loss of, like, Keith Jones, who lost his son aboard the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. We feature Clayton Mathern, who he was out actually about a half mile from the rig when it exploded working on a supply ship, and he went into search and rescue mode immediately and was pulling bodies from the water. And he actually was one of the worst cases that we have seen in terms of the chemical exposure. He's very, very ill. Actually, during our interview, he was rushed to the hospital, and he was diagnosed with paralysis in one of his legs as a result. And then, you know, the communities that we spent time with around the world, Constance Okollet in Uganda, who is a community leader and activist for her people there, and showed us around the impacts that they are facing from climate change. The folks up in Kivalina were wonderful, showing us the erosion on the island up there and what the warming climate has done in terms of basically tearing apart their island and reducing it considerably to the point they have to move. So a lot of interesting stories. You know, we tried to get some of the executives from the big oil companies on camera, and of course they denied us, but we went out of our way to make sure we at least tried. I did get into the Exxon Mobil shareholders meeting, and we took undercover video of that, and I got up and confronted Rex Tillerson, the CEO, about their climate change denial funding. So that was kind of the fun part. But we have a lot of good stories and a lot of great people in the film.
So what now? Are you entering this film in festivals, and when does it come out for the general public?
Yes, we just got finished entering a rough cut to Sundance Film Festival. And right now we're busy working, finishing up our final cut, and that'll probably take us through the rest of the year. And we expect that the film will be ready to be released in the festival circuit as well as ideally worldwide in early 2012.
And I guess a little bit later, would you be selling DVDs online? Because it's never going to come to my local cinema.
Yes, definitely. It'll depend on the distribution deal we get and how soon, you know, the materials are released, but we'll definitely have DVDs available online.
And Craig, you know, the American Petroleum Institute will probably have at least one desk set up just to track you and your film to discredit it. They've got money to burn, and they don't take kindly to criticism. Have you had any pushback?
Not yet, but I'll be honest, we expect it. And, you know, in terms of our opinion, if they come at us trying to discredit anything we say in the film, we made sure that we backed up all of our facts with very legitimate sources. And, you know, I think that all it's going to do is increase the media attention for the film and for our message. So we're happy to talk with them.
Well, in the end, do you leave us in the oil pit with these monsters, or do you have suggestions in the film to motivate change?
The problem with this industry and this issue is that there isn't an easy answer. We can't flick a switch and go off all these dirty sources of energy tomorrow. We can decide as a nation and as a world to wean ourselves off of them, though, as soon as possible, and to really put a priority into investing into clean energies and clean technologies to ensure we have a planet that's livable for our future generations. And we're not doing that now. So that's something we really need to do. And in terms of addressing, you know, a solution within the film, we basically point out what the problem is in terms of who's perpetuating it, and we leave the audience with a website which is still under development, but it's going to be a very lengthy yet easy to navigate website that really can get people involved both in their local as well as the national community to try and make a difference.
But you've got a trailer up now to tease us. Where would we find that?
Yes, we have a trailer on our website at greedylyingbastards.com, and you can kind of read more about the film. There's a synopsis on there. There's some press clippings as well as the trailer.
Our guest is Craig Rosebrough. He wrote and directed, even appears in a new film with the quiet little title, Greedy Lying Bastards. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for coming along with us. Radio EcoShock, now on 42 college and community radio stations. Welcome, Nimbin FM, Australia. Before we talk coral and the coming mass extinction, here's a bit more from WholeLotOfFrackingGoingOn.com.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drill is making killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranes reaches 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep a far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below. The groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the rest. Residents of Summer Way out, that was frack. We're talking benzene.
What the fuck is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Here on Radio EcoShock, you've heard speakers like Dr. Daniel Pauly lament that humans are stripping the oceans bare of species. I've played you a clip of Dr. Wes Jackson on the possibility of a mass extinction event in the seas, and paleoclimatologist Peter Ward told us up to 90% of ocean life has been killed off in a big extinction event that happened many millions of years ago. These things can happen, so I took this all in mind when I got a new book from Peter F. Sale. He works with the United Nations University, and he is a professor emeritus at the University of Windsor, Ontario. Peter Sale, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
I'm glad to be there, Alex.
Peter, the title of your book, it turned me off at first. It's called Our Dying Planet, An Ecologist's View of the Crisis We Face. Sometimes I'm called extreme. Why would you say the planet is dying?
Obviously, we're not talking about the planet dying. The planet isn't alive. But what we are talking about is the most serious environmental crisis we've faced since the Pleistocene.
I'd say you were exaggerating, but a new study published in the journal Nature found 75% of all mammal species on the land are at risk of extinction within 300 years.
One of the reasons I wrote the book was I was more and more alarmed at what I was seeing in my own studies of coral reefs and in what I was reading from other areas of environmental science. And I was concerned that the majority of people had very little appreciation of just how serious a problem we're creating for ourselves. And I thought, well, what can I do? I'm a teacher. Maybe I can provide something that will educate people.
Well, let's back up a little bit and retrace your own steps in science. You have a lot of expertise in coral reefs, and I found your description of what coral is, how it works, really kept me interested. Talk to us for a minute about the wonders of coral.
A coral reef only exists under quite narrow environmental conditions. They don't occur outside the tropics because reef-building corals cannot tolerate cold water. They don't occur in deep water because they've got to be shallow enough because the corals have a symbiotic alga that lives within their tissues. And these algae have got to be able to do photosynthesis, which means they need light, so the reef has to be close to the surface. They've got to have high-quality water, unpolluted, or the corals die. So there's really narrow requirements, and you only find them in some places. So when you see a reef, you're seeing a fortunate set of events that have happened. Coral reefs have been with us since the Ordovician, about 425 million years ago. There's been several times in the past where there have been no reefs for 20 million years or so, when conditions weren't right, but the corals have managed to persist in tiny little populations that got through those 20 million year gaps. And when the conditions are right, we get this flowering of the most diverse marine community on Earth, and in some ways the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. Rainforests trump reefs in terms of how many species they have in them, because rainforests have an inordinate number of insects. But coral reefs are more diverse than rainforests if you look at, for example, how many phyla of organisms they have, how many families or orders of organisms they have. It is a much broader diversity than the diversity of the rainforest. Or to give you a number, 25% of marine species live on coral reefs. Now, not all of those 25% are restricted to coral reefs, and if coral reefs disappear, some of those 25% will still be around. But we're talking about a quarter of all the organisms that live in the ocean are associated with coral reefs. So they are absolutely wonderful. Unfortunately, we have been hammering away at them in various ways, and now with climate change, we're doing things to them which are literally going to lead to another one of these long gaps of tens of thousands of millions of years without reefs, unless we change what we're doing to the climate.
Right, so this living treasure is possibly starting to die off. Tell us about mass bleaching events.
Okay, before I do that, let me just comment on the term living treasure. It's a treasure biologically. It is also a treasure to the countries that have them along their shores. These are extremely valuable ecosystems. The Great Barrier Reef is valued as worth several billion dollars a year to the Australian economy, primarily through tourism, but also through fisheries. If you go to the Caribbean, most of the Caribbean basin countries get 50% or more of their GDP from their coastal activities, and these are tourism and fishing. And while many of the tourists don't actually go and look at the reef, they just sit on the beach is produced by sand, which comes from the reef. So these reefs are tremendously valuable economically. They also do a lot of coastal protection, which doesn't even factor in when you talk about GDP. Coral bleaching. I've got a picture of coral bleaching on the front of the book. Looks beautiful. Beautiful white coral, as far as the eye can see. And what has happened is the corals have been stressed by high temperatures. Because they're stressed, they have evicted their algal symbiotic cells, and the algae are what have the color. So the algae leave, and you're left with this translucent coral, and what you're looking at is the white skeleton shining through the translucent tissues of the coral. As I say, it can look beautiful to the uninformed, but it's beautiful deaf, because if the stressed conditions last for 3 weeks or so, the corals die. And the first recorded what we call mass bleaching, where lots and lots of coral was bleached, was in 1983. We're pretty sure it had never happened before that in human history. It has happened frequently since that, such that the estimates are that about 20% of the living coral in the world has been killed off already by coral bleaching.
So do we think that bleaching is related to climate change?
It's definitely related to climate change. What is happening is the climate change is causing an increase in sea surface temperatures. And obviously, there are seasonal fluctuations in temperatures, and there are things such as the El Nino events, where you get warmer than usual sea surface temperatures in particular periods during an El Nino. And basically, what happens is the corals are living very close to the maximum temperatures they can tolerate in the summertime. If you get an El Nino in the summertime, they get extra hot. With climate change, they're now getting sufficiently hot that they're getting stressed, they're getting bleached, and they're dying.
But one of the things I think you really draw out well in your book, and building on this coral theme idea, is that it isn't just one cause. It isn't just climate change. You've got all the pollution that's happening, the damage to the reefs from tourism. There's a lot of things that humans do that damage the environment. Do you find that that's one of the difficulties, is trying to get people to accept complex reasons why things happen as opposed to one single thing?
Yes, I agree with you completely, and that is another reason why I wrote the book. One of the points I wanted to make in writing this book was that we have one big, complicated problem, not a series of separate problems. It's too easy to stand them up separately, and then you can get people arguing as to whether we should be dealing with climate change or pollution or overfishing or deforestation or invading species. We need to stop, step back, and say, hey, these are all related. They're all part of the same thing. You can't deal with one without dealing with the others. And I think if people knew how serious it was, they would be a lot more motivated than they are to try and do something about it.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and educator Peter F. Sale. His new book is Our Dying Planet, an ecologist's view of the crisis we face. I mentioned Dr. Daniel Pauly in the introduction. He's now at the University of British Columbia. He talks about something called the shifting baseline syndrome. Could you talk to us about that?
Yes, and I'm delighted you mentioned Daniel Pauly, because I remember meeting him years ago in Australia at a meeting when he and I were both a lot younger. And he was a dynamic and interesting scientist then, and he still is. And he's been one of those people who has been diligently putting the information out there, telling people what we're doing to the ocean. His concept of the shifting baseline, I've got a chapter on it in the book. We don't notice change when it happens slowly. He called it the shifting baseline. You have a baseline of what you think things used to be like, and then you look at how they are now. But the baseline keeps shifting each generation because people only look back to a few years ago. They don't look back hundreds of years ago. Because we don't notice it, we're not aware of it. Because we're not aware of it, we're not concerned about it. Most people you talk to, most Canadians you talk to, if you say something about climate change, they say, oh, yes, but it's only going to warm up a couple of degrees. But that is immense. And it's having immense consequences to many aspects of our weather, our hydrological system, the availability of water in our ecosystem. All of these things are being changed by those tiny little changes in climate, and the problem is those changes are progressive.
Now, another barrier to our understanding this ecological crisis is the way our brains work. Most of us, and I have to admit, sometimes me, we have trouble comprehending what you call exponential change. Could you give us an example, maybe, or help us through that one?
Well, the example I love is the apocryphal story of the young man who's traveling and comes across a damsel in distress and rescues her from the dragon and discovers she's the princess, and the king wants to reward him. And the young man says, as a reward, he would like one grain of wheat on the first square of his chessboard, then two grains on the second square, and four grains on the third square, and eight grains on the fourth square. And the king says, no, 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 I want to give you something really significant. The young man holds his ground, and of course the king agrees to do this. He empties his granary. He empties his treasury, buying grain from his neighbors. The fact is the king goes completely bankrupt producing the amount of grain which the young man was asking for. Exponential change is what that story talks about. Something which increases at an increasing rate. And there's lots of examples of exponential change in the world. One of the best is the change growth of the human population, which until quite recently was exponentially increasing. Thankfully, it's now slowing down a little bit, but it is still increasing dangerously. And we do not understand these kinds of rapid change in numbers or amounts or any of the other things. And because we don't understand them and don't appreciate them, we get into trouble. We get into trouble with exponential change in managing our credit card debt because the interest applies onto the interest and it exponentially increases, and suddenly you discover you can't pay off your credit card because you let it build up too high. That's exponential change. It's very painful when it runs away like that. And we've got examples of that in our environmental crisis.
Including, I believe, the rate at which carbon dioxide is going into the atmosphere. It's increasing a little bit every year so that it's growing, not just because a year went by, but because it's actually growing in the rate that we're emitting.
Yeah, it's not growing exponentially if one wants to be mathematically, you know, technically accurate, but it is growing at an increasing rate. So the line is not straight up. It's not a straight line increasing the same amount each year. It's a little bit more each year. And incidentally, the business about climate change and evidence for it, you can go on the web anytime to the NOAA site and see the data on the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere over Mauna Loa. The data are right there. You see the graph increasing upwards. It's almost at 390, it's just over 390 parts per million now. People who say, oh, I don't believe in it, those people mostly are people who simply decided this is something they don't want to believe in. It's a little unpleasant, so I'll build a little wall around it, and then I'll go on with my life with that little bit of my memory walled off, and I won't think about it. But the evidence is all around us, and the data are all around us. The data are remarkably publicly available.
Well, Peter, we don't have to worry about it because the balance of nature will always come back. Nature's pretty self-regulating. She should take care of this situation just the way we were taught in school.
Yeah, I wish it were true. This is another one of the things that I try and talk about as clearly as possible in the book. We have an amazing faith in the capacity of the natural world to deal with the things we do to it and recover from them. And the fact of the matter is the natural world is far less in balance than we think it is. There are far fewer things out there that will make it repair itself. And we should have known this a long time ago. We have repeatedly overfished particular populations of fish and watched them collapse, and they never come back or very rarely come back. You know, I talk about the Atlantic cod in the book. The Atlantic cod sustained a vigorous fishery, a tremendously valuable fishery, for about 500 years, but we finally finished them off. And yes, there are still cod out there, and there's still hopeful fishermen and hopeful government scientists, and maybe they will come back, because sometimes it happens. But there's nothing pushing them back. There's no law that says if you stop fishing, it will rebound instantly to where it was. Our faith in the balance of nature is totally unrealistic and unjustified.
Well, Peter, although you cover some solutions in a later chapter, you do have a haunting description of how a continuing loss of species could play out. Humans may not recognize the loss until it's way too late. Can you tell us just a little bit about what that experience would be like?
At the present time, we are in the middle, or in the early stages, perhaps, of what people are now calling the Holocene mass extinction. There have been five mass extinctions in the past, and the biggest was the end of the Permian, when 90% of species went extinct. If it had been 100%, we wouldn't be here talking about it, and there would never have been any dinosaurs. The experiment with life would have been over. Fortunately, it was only 90%. But believe me, if you take away 90% of species, you substantially change the ecology, and you substantially alter what's going to happen next. We are in the middle of the most rapid increase in the rate of extinction that has occurred in geological history. It is caused by us. We started out in the Pleistocene when we learned how to hunt in groups. We became quite good at finishing off large mammals. We have gone on and finished off lots of fish species and lots of other animals by over-hunting them. We now typically cause extinctions of species by altering their habitat so they cannot survive, or taking over their habitat and changing it totally into something else. So we're very good at causing the extinction of species. People such as Edward Wilson at Harvard University and a number of others have looked at this in detail. They've looked at the rates at which species are disappearing, and they're making predictions like 50% or more of all species on Earth gone by 2100. That is enormous, and that doesn't say the process stops at 2100, because if we keep going the way we're going, we'll still be causing extinction. What you have to do is imagine a forest with hardly any kinds of trees left, or imagine a forest with no kinds of trees left. If you don't have any tree species, you don't have a forest anymore. And if you don't have a forest, there's lots of other things that disappear. And I believe the extent of the biodiversity loss, which is what this is so great that we should be really very concerned about it, because we need these things. These creatures out there, these plant species and these animal species and even the microbes, we need them. They provide our food. They provide our environment. They provide the oxygen in the air we breathe. They provide what we use for our lives. And we're part of it. We can't survive without the rest of it. And I think the loss of species that is predicted is so extreme that we would be foolish to assume that somehow none of the species that really matter to us will get lost. They will. And then what do we do? Because we don't yet know how to create life.
If you are just tuning in, our guest on Radio EcoShock is author and ecologist Peter F. Sale. In your book, Our Dying Planet, you suggest there are four possible paths for our civilization now. I'd like to take just a few minutes to talk about them. Let's start with that Belvedere world. Why call it that, and what does it look like?
I called it Belvedere because Belvedere sounds luxurious and comfortable. And that is exactly what the world looks like to those people on the inside. And basically, the Belvedere world is the one we're headed towards on a 8-lane superhighway as fast as we can get there. It is a world of gated communities, fortress communities, armored communities, living in luxury inside their walls, protected from the nasty environment outside. And then between these gated communities, there's kind of a Mad Max sort of a world of people living in horrible conditions with famine and starvation and war and disease and all the other bad things you don't want to think about. This, I fear, is the world we're going to go towards as the rich countries initially make sure they have what they want, to hell with the rest, and then as things deteriorate even further, it will become the rich communities within the rich countries that become the gated communities. And some people will live for several generations in quite wonderful surroundings, but ultimately they will either be vanquished by the desperate hordes, or they will die of diseases which get in through all kinds of fortification, and I don't see it as a good solution. It's not the solution I would want to see, but that's the most likely one we're headed towards, and all of our current behavior in the developed countries suggests that's the world we're going towards.
That's the me first world. Well,
the me first world.
Yeah. Well, you have a second scenario that sounds more friendly, at least for me. You call it the Woodstock future. What do you mean there?
The Woodstock future is the one that you hear typically put forward by people who want to argue against changing our energy strategies. The people who want to argue that there's no way we can have an advanced civilization and have carbon-free fuels. The Woodstock world is a world of people living in very basic surroundings with minimal enterprise, minimal energy sources, a sort of a fondly hippie-esque movement where you go back to basics and you don't have international trade and you do not have all the things that we now think of as making up our advanced civilization. You give up the things that take energy as a way of stopping using energy. You go back to an agrarian society. It becomes a much simpler society. It could be a very attractive society in some ways, but I don't think it's a society we're going to choose to get to because people don't want to give things up. So it's a society that I don't actually see it as coming. It is possible, but I don't see it as coming because most people won't want to have it. And if people don't want to have it, it's not going to happen.
And you contrast that with your third possible future called Technopolis, and I guess that's self-explanatory, or is it?
I think it is. Technopolis is the future, and there are people out there right now who are solving, in their own minds, solving the climate change problem by building elaborate sunscreens that will be floated up in space, or are they going to pump sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere to counteract the intensity of the sunlight and reflect the light away so we don't heat up so much? I mean, it's a technical solution to everything. This is the future where science and engineering solve all problems without any difficulty at all. We just invent our way out of the mess we're making. I think the Technopolis future has one absolutely huge flaw, and the flaw is that we only have one planet to live on, and if we make a mistake, we have screwed ourselves. I don't believe that any technical advance has ever gone forward without mistakes being made, and I don't think we have the luxury of making mistakes. It is a commonly held belief by those people who genuinely believe that we do not need the natural world, we can do without it. We'll simply invent replacements for the things the natural world provides for us. There are people who will try and move in that direction, and I think it'll be a failure. And when I say a failure, I mean a failure with a collapse of civilization. I think it would happen.
But you do see a fourth alternative pathway. What is that?
And my fourth alternative I call New Atlantis. This is obviously the one that I favor. This is a world where we have advanced civilization. We have all the toys and the inventions which we love. We have an intellectually vibrant civilization. We have culture and the arts and the sciences and all these things going on. But we are living in a world which is sustainably managed, a world which continues to provide the environmental goods and services that our lives depend upon. This is a world which is reachable, but it is a much more difficult one to reach than Belvedere because it's going to require that we make some quite difficult changes quite soon. We have got to look at how we use fuel, and we have got to use different fuels. We have got to find ways of being much more efficient in our use of energy so that we do not waste it and pollute in the process. We have got to look at our overuse of natural resources, the renewable resources, like the resources provided from our farms, from forests, from fisheries, making sure that we are using those at a rate which is sustainably replaceable year after year. And I think inevitably in this world we have got to look at a human population which is not growing, and preferably a human population which is smaller than the one we currently have.
As we finish off, is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners?
The most important thing I would like to say is don't get depressed by this kind of news. There's no point in sitting around being depressed. Become active. Talk to people about it. Talk to them about the fact that you can't simply put environmental problems on one side while you deal with other things.
This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Peter F. Sale. He's currently involved with United Nations University, and he's a professor emeritus at the University of Windsor. Peter knows the sea and its creatures, and that comes out in his new book, provocatively titled Our Dying Planet, from the University of California Press. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
It was wonderful to talk to you, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. We'll go out with Talking Drums by Ariel Kalma.